Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Dr. Anila Puddy, to the Autism Roundtable, where we are exploring the world of neurodivergence, children on the autism spectrum. You come with such nice background and experience. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a doctor and focusing on pediatrics? Tell us a little bit about how you got there and what you specialize on today.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me today. It's an amazing chance to connect with you and with families that I work with every day, but it goes past the diagnosis point, so this is really, really nice. And I love your podcast. I've listened to a bunch of your episodes, so I love it.
Thank you. And I'm always looking for individuals that really share my vision of providing the complete package to families, of going a little bit beyond what, you know, what's expected and really, really pulling through for families. So tell us a little bit about, maybe start with your education and then tell us a little bit about where you ended up today.
Absolutely. So I graduated medical school probably literally in a different century in Ross University School of Medicine in Dominica. And I have been a physician now. Then I went into pediatrics, and that's a very funny story because as a medical student, pediatrics was the last rotation I did because I was so scared of parents. I said, I'm going to be terrible at this. I don't have any younger siblings. I don't have kids of my own. I don't know how to manage them and handle them. And then when I finished, I actually completely changed my route on what I wanted to do for my whole life within 3 months, because I said, oh my gosh, yes, parents are all a little crazy, but that's okay. I actually really love that about them. And what I love more than anything are kids and children who are just the most resilient little things that I've ever met in my whole life. And so that's, you know, I got into pediatrics, and then into pediatrics once again, I didn't even know developmental behavioral pediatrics existed. I was going into pediatric ER because I liked the speed and the pressure and watching too many seasons of ER growing up. I thought it was going to be amazing. Then again, I did a month of developmental peds, and Dr. Barrows, my mentor then, was just so incredible. And then she mentored me and she said, you're good at this. You like this. And I said, I do. Is that insane? And she's like, no, this is the point. This is the reason you do electives. And so that started my journey. And I did my fellowship at Rutgers University in New Jersey and worked with Children's Specialized Hospital. After I graduated, I was an attending with them for many years. I've been an attending at Penn State University in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I'm currently actually still working part-time in Apple Pediatrics in the city. And it has been an incredible, incredible journey. None of it I would have planned. None of it I would have told you was in the cards for me, you know, a year before it actually happened. And that's, you know, testament to what you always have to kind of be ready for, what opportunities are thrown your way, and be ready to pick them up.
I love that. I love that vision. And what was it about pediatrics that really pulled you? What was so inspiring about them? What did you love?
I trained at Brookdale University in East Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York, and it is a very tough neighborhood, very, very tough neighborhood. And the children who grow up there, you know, they might have all the talent in the world, but most of them don't get the opportunities that they deserve. And they are resilient. They are pushing through. And it was an incredible population to train with because it really taught you what it meant to be hopeful. Eternally hopeful and strong. I have had five-year-olds diagnosed with cancer, coming back for the third or fourth time and being like, okay, great, put the port in, let me get my Wii, and we'll get started. There's so little self-pity in children. You know, they are not lazy. They are amazing, incredible little things that can be molded into the future. And for me, that was where I belonged, because it wasn't too late. It was, you know, you didn't grow up and lose that eternal hope, you know, and that sort of resilience. And I just felt that that was the time. That was when I needed to capture them and help them in every way I could.
I love that. I love the topic of resilience in children, because as parents, I think sometimes we think, can they really do it? Can I push them? Is it okay that they're working this hard? And you bring up a really great topic of that they are resilient, and they do somehow, they look around that classroom or around their environment and they say, I want to be like everybody else, or I want to be able to complete whatever it is. And they really push through, and we really see that in children. And it could give us inspiration as adults as far as what our resilience should look like.
Absolutely. And what it means to be yourself. You know, I work with the neurodivergent population, and they are fighting every day when to mask, when to unmask, when to be themselves, when to conform to society. And they fight every day on this struggle, things that a lot of us, especially neurotypicals, don't even think about, you know, don't even worry about. And I think, you know, something that is more relatable is an introvert versus an extrovert. You never know the struggles of an introvert unless you're an introvert. The extrovert doesn't even think about it. It's the same idea of a neurodivergent and a neurotypical, is that you don't even realize. And parents of neurodivergent children are so incredible, because they always say they've learned so much from their kids about, you know, how to be strong internally and how to persevere and how to put up with all the therapies and with all the schedules and the strangers in their house. And it is amazing and an incredible lesson for parents in looking at their kids and going, whoa, you're amazing. I'm so proud of you, and you're amazing. And I, as an adult, am learning from you on how to do this.
It's fascinating. Amazing. Amazing. Okay, so tell us a little bit where you are right now, because I know you opened up Turtle Pediatrics and you had a vision. So tell us a little bit about that vision and how you're bringing it to fruition.
Yes, thank you. So Turtle Pediatrics was founded early in 2025. And I've been a developmental pediatrician, as I said, in multiple states, in multiple big box hospitals, in smaller community areas. And I was sort of pushed into this entire telemedicine remote business, remote medicine, you know, thing in 2020, just like every doctor was. And unless you work in the ER, you know, or inpatient, you had to figure out how to do this from your kitchen table. And at first, I hated it. My parents hated it. It was stressful. It was confusing. I had a lot of families who weren't tech savvy, who thought maybe something would be missed over the camera. And then by the end of 2020, I would say 70 to 80% of them would get on the call and they'd say, oh my gosh, I can cook dinner while I talk to you. He can just sit and play with his own toys, and I don't have to stress about putting him in a car in the middle of winter, driving him to an office that he does not like, where he will not perform to his full extent. And so that really moved me. And then through the years, I started to dabble more and more with this entire idea of remote practice. And that's what brings us to 2025 is, like I said, I still am part-time at Apple Pediatrics, where I am the remote developmental pediatrician. And I realized, you know, like a lot of, I think, professionals do at a certain point of their age, maybe this is the new midlife crisis, is, hey, I kind of want to be my own boss, and I want to do things the way I've always wanted to do things. And so many different hospitals have taught me so many different ways of doing this. And I wanted, and I believed in this model of telemedicine, that you need to go to where the parents need you, not the other way around. And so that is what was the founding model for Turtle Pediatrics, that we are fully remote. We are coming into a family's house through a webcam and seeing their kid at their best, at their worst and at their best, I should say, because I see the tantrums. I see them playing on their own carpet with their own toys, you know, being comfortable, on their own jungle gym, getting on their high chair and eating their own food. And I get to observe all the behaviors that I need to see, like fine motor, gross motor, social emotional communication with the parent. You know, does he keep hitting mom? Does he keep jumping up and down on grandma? Does the brother get the brunt of the caretaking responsibilities? You know, is he really kind to the cat? These are not things that come through in a cold office setting. And to me, that's everything. And so that is the philosophy of Turtle Pediatrics, is that it's at your own pace. You thrive at your own pace. You get evaluated at your own pace, in your own home, and your own comfort level. And that's when you should be diagnosed, not when you're doing your worst or you're having a bad day.
And I love that. I love how you really are meeting the parents where they're at and taking that on by yourself in a way. Like, you know, when we work for others, a lot of times we're told what we need to be doing, how we need to be doing, what the vision of the practice is. And when you go ahead and you make your own practice, you're able to do your own vision. So tell us a little bit about how you do support the parents. Well, actually, let's back up a minute. Let's talk a little bit about the diagnosis process. It's very overwhelming to parents, the diagnosis process. Sometimes we're not ready to accept a diagnosis. We're not sure if we want a diagnosis. We have an inkling in the back of our head. Something is off. This is not, you know, the way the other children are behaving in the class, or this is not, you know, the developmental appropriate. My child's not meeting the milestones they're supposed to be meeting. Maybe I need to go for a diagnosis. I'm not sure. Give us a little bit of guidance as far as when a parent should reach out, and then what sort of happens when they do.
Absolutely. And this goes across the board. This isn't just for me at Turtle Pediatrics. This is for any developmental pediatrician. So that's the first hardest begin, you know, part of it all is the words. Is it a neurologist? Is it a developmentalist? Is it a behaviorist? Are we therapists? You know, I say bottom line always comes down to you have your general pediatrician. And the second you're worried that your kid is doing something different, isn't where he should be, you talk to your general pediatrician. Two things can happen. Your general pediatrician is amazing, and they listen to you and they believe you and they immediately send you to me, which is the point. You come to a developmental pediatrician when milestones are being missed, when you are worried about autism, when you're worried about ADHD, when you're worried about a learning disability, when you're worried about your kid having intellectual disability, which used to be called mental retardation, when you just feel like they're just not where they're supposed to be, especially for new parents. There was no handbook. This is hard. So we have websites like the CDC that have the list of milestones that you could look up and say, oh, okay, my 18-month-old is supposed to be talking already. Oh, the doctor said this was fine. Oh, the doctor said that he's just a boy and he'll catch up and boys are lazy and things like that. So that comes to the second option, unfortunately, sometimes, is that they don't believe you. We're fallible human beings, as is doctors. And I will forever apologize for all the bad pediatricians out there who don't listen to their families, who don't believe the mom and dad, and who don't believe in immediate referrals. And for those, I say, you've got everything you need at your fingertips. Go to the CDC website, look up the milestones, go to the Autism Speaks website, and look up the symptoms of autism and say, wait, there's something going on, and you don't need a referral. You know, some insurance is needed, but you can reach out to the developmental pediatrician and say, hey, I need help. And they can reach out to the pediatrician and say, hey, I'm about to see this kid, send me a referral. And that's as easy as it is. And the idea is that anybody who's between the ages of 18 months and, you know, 20, 21, 22 years, depends on the developmental pediatrician, but we see kids from 18 months to 22 years, you can book the appointment and get on to the next hurdle, which is sometimes the wait list. We don't have a wait list, but others do. And parents should know that from the moment they feel that something is wrong, you need to start the journey, because this is a marathon and you're going to have lots of hurdles. You're going to have to be strong, but persevere and keep pushing for your child, because that you are who they have. So if you're concerned, get on the website. If you're not sure, start talking to your pediatrician and get on websites. Ask questions. Ask your other moms. You know, get in touch with a developmental pediatrician as soon as possible, because the sooner the diagnosis, the sooner the therapies, the better the outcome.
Exactly. And I love how you put that in there, that the sooner the therapy, the better the outcome. Because when we work with young children, we see so much faster results because their brains are still developing. And those that are like, a lot of times I have clients that ask me, like, what would happen if I push it off? Or like, if I ignore it, will it go away? And we're very, you know, we know at this point that no, these kind of big scale issues are not going away. And if you have that inkling in your heart that something's wrong, you know, ignorance is not bliss. And just not knowing doesn't mean the problem doesn't exist. Instead, it grows. It like, it just keeps on growing until then you can't ignore it. So if you're able to come to terms with it and seek out the right information, the right diagnosis, what it really does is help direct your path and how you could best help your child. And a diagnosis is only a diagnosis. It doesn't mean that that defines your child.
Absolutely. And I think that brings us to the second part of your question, which is, what does the evaluation look like? You know, and the evaluation, why a developmental pediatrician is required, is because of the time and training they've had in specifically that problem of developmental delays. So they have the questions they're asking, and while, you know, you may be diagnosed with somebody else, they are the ones who've trained for this. You know, I spent probably from beginning to end 15 years of training to get to this point. So I see, this is my bread and butter. I see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids every year, and I can pick up things. I know what questions to ask. So you get a full evaluation, and then you get an observational evaluation. Some other practices will do slightly different versions of it, but in the end, we're all testing for the same thing. We are all looking for the DSM-5 criteria, which is the gold standard for diagnosing whether it's developmental delays, whether it's autism or ADHD or learning disability or anything in between. That's what we're all using, and that's what needs to be checked off in order for you to get the diagnosis. But your developmental pediatrician is so much more. They are also your medical home, which means after the diagnosis, they should know where to send you. They should be able to give you the support that you need. Do you need social support? Do you need family support? Do you need the therapy set up? Do you need help calling people? Do you need, and you know, what's unique for me, and I enjoy it, is that you need your developmental pediatrician to also be your social worker. You need to be able to have that person to call and say, oh, I just saw a study on autism and Saffron, ADHD and Saffron, I should say. Is it okay? Okay, let me do the research. Let me find out. And yes, there are some studies that show, you know, ADHD treatment and Saffron treatment to be something that is a thing. You need that person. You need that medical home. So that is what makes a developmental pediatrician special. They are not a therapist. They will diagnose you and they will help and guide you through the next process, because this is a lifetime process. You know, what is a guardianship? What is an IEP? What is a 504? What is ABA? What is Sunrise? You know, you have somebody who can answer all of these questions for you, and that's who they are, and that's what they should be.
Yeah, they should be that. And then if your pediatrician or your neurodevelopmental pediatrician is not doing that, I love how you just listed a bunch of different resources as well. You know, on our website, Circle Care Services, we also have like a guide of different, you know, services that you could reach out to and you could research. But your doctor's office should have a list and should be able to guide you into the right direction. Because once you get that diagnosis, it's sort of a little bit of a roadmap of what services are now available. And parents that get the diagnosis, a lot of times they're like, wow, now I'm a little bit relieved because now I know what the issue is and I know how to solve the problem.
Absolutely. And that's the whole point, to remove the hurdles that you know are going to be there. And for Turtle Pediatrics, something special that I've been able to do because I've been, this is my baby, is vet everybody that I send them to. So, you know, sometimes you're told, okay, you have the diagnosis. All right, go Google ABA therapy, right? Figure out, go call your insurance company and get the list and call them all. And some places like Jersey and New York, that's a lot. That's a big list. And half of them might have wait lists. Half of them might not take your insurance. And it's important for your developmental pediatrician to have a short list of places like, okay, you're in this zip code. These two or three places might be great for you. And I mean, your Circle Care services were such a perfect example. I had a family move down to Georgia and they were completely lost and they were having issues. And I just called you up and I said, oh my gosh, I was able to tell the families, I know an ABA company there. Go to them and they will help you. And they were able to get the help they needed. But if I was just like, well, just Google an ABA there, you know, good luck. That's the point. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, and it is scary just to take any services just because they're ABA or just because they're occupational therapy or speech therapy or a neurodevelopmental or a pediatrician. Really reaching out to your community, reaching out to your supports, reaching out to your school, reaching out to other parents that are going through something similar. It's important to hear, like, what's available out there and why did you choose that one over that one? And doing a little bit of research, as if we would research anything else that's important to us before I go buy, I don't know, I'm doing presents now for Hanukkah. I'm like, before I go buy the Uggs, I want to make sure I'm getting the right ones and I'm researching the pricing, right? So before I make any step in my life, I do a little bit of research to make sure that I'm on target, that I'm within the right price point, that I'm getting the best quality, right? So if we're doing that on our materialistic items, imagine our children, our greatest treasures, we want to make sure that we're really getting the best for them. So doing that little bit of research, reaching out to resources, calling around a couple people, maybe a therapist that are ready in your life or, you know, just your social support circle. And if you don't have one, it's so easy to get into one on Facebook or, you know, within your community, library. Like, you could go anywhere and you'll usually be able to find a support system of sorts if you're looking for it. And ask, because we don't want to go into this blindly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think information gathering is so easy these days that, just like you said, you need to look at all the information. You need to make sure that the information is correct. And we live in a crazy world where there's a lot of crazy things happening, and we need to be careful on what we believe and what we don't. And, you know, places that are there for you should be there for you. They shouldn't be there for you with a caveat, with an asterisk. You know, when you're looking for special therapies for your child, oh, this, they say that this cures my kid, but it happens to cost $700 a month, you know? You have to be so careful these days because everybody's out there claiming facts that are not facts and claiming treatments and cures that are not proven and can sometimes be dangerous. So a lot of my counseling for my families goes towards, like, please do your own research. This is the research I've done for you. For example, the saffron one, I did have a parent ask me that 2 days ago, and that's why it was fresh in my mind, because they're not ready to put their four-year-old on any medications. Understandable, totally. The medication is not always the answer. But they're, you know, the dad saw saffron studies on giving saffron. And so I researched it and found a few articles on Google Scholar and vetted them, and I sent them to him, and I said, continue to do your research, but understand how to source your material properly. And that's so, so important these days. But yeah, you got to do your research.
Got to do your research. Now, you touched on a little bit of the struggle of being a parent or the challenge of being a parent. And I do think that a lot of parents have guilt-related to diagnosing, whether to diagnose, whether not to diagnose, why their child needs a diagnosis. Does it have to do with something that they did to bring on the diagnosis? When speaking to parents, is this something that you see often?
I have never been apologized to more than when a kid picks up an iPad for 2 seconds on my calls. Because the thing about being home is you have all your toys, you have everything. And then immediately I get the apology and I said, oh my gosh, we messed up somewhere as doctors. Parental guilt is an incredibly toxic thing. And while sometimes it's a little funny, it's so, so dangerous to constantly have our parents feel bad about the choices they've made, blame them for the choices they've made. Medications that parents took when they're pregnant, parents, moms took when they were pregnant, right? The blame game on, oh, does this cause your kid's autism? Did this? Let's look at this. Let's look at how much, carrots you ate. Maybe that's what caused it. Even the idea of so many of these studies that look into these things, you really wonder about the bias that's coming in with this. Because I think what started off as guidance turned into blame. You better not have any screen time for your child. That makes you a bad parent. Dude, I'm trying to make dinner. He can hang on to the iPad for 10 minutes while I make dinner. Like, let it go. I feel so bad, especially for neurodivergent parents who are the parents that I speak with day in and day out. The level of guilt. What do you mean you can't come pick up your kid for the fourth time from school? You're such a bad parent. How can you not leave work every day to get him, you know? Oh, I think he should have ABA therapy, speech therapy, OT therapy in all three different places, and I want you to take to them. And if you don't take them to all of these things, your kid will suffer, and it's your fault. You took Tylenol when you were pregnant? Oh, it's your fault, you know? And us as developmental pediatricians, as people who work with these families, are just not able to keep up with telling families it's okay, it's not your fault. Look at those studies. They were flawed. Look at the, you know, what's coming out. Look at, you know, who's funding these things and who's saying this to you. Don't let them make you feel bad. You're doing the best you can. This is hard. There was no handbook for you. Yeah. It's okay.
Exactly. And sometimes, like, we do want to blame things, you know. I think our gut is, like, let's blame someone for this. Like, if it's not going right, right? Let's just blame. And really, I think what we have to remember is that we have to move forward, and dwelling on the blame or dwelling on the reason really doesn't help anyone or anything. And it's not going to prevent something from happening because he's already here and you're in the situation already. So to start blaming or putting reasons behind it was in his family, or it was in her family, and that's why, or like to find the reason, yeah. Does it help anyone?
Exactly, right? It does not help anybody. And it does not help anybody to look at the other parent and go, oh, you know, this is why. We all want to know the reason, but I always tell families the day that I diagnose them, this is the worst it's ever going to be. Because from this moment on, we're going to get the help he needs. And whether that's, you know, a very late diagnosis, which is a major, major thing that I see, and they feel very, very guilty. Oh, I brought this up and nobody believed me and now it's too late. And no, it's never too late. Early is good. The earlier the better. Wonderful. But it's never too late and it is not your fault. You know, don't let anybody villainize you. You did the best you could. And I tell the families that every day. You have done the best you could. You got them here. You got them to an appointment. You spoke up. You said something. And now they're getting the help they need. From today on, we're going to get you hooked up into every kind of help there is. But don't look back and say, do the hindsight game. Because it only hurts. And it doesn't give you the credit you deserve for showing up. For speaking up and showing up. It is not easy to speak up to against a pediatrician. It is not easy to speak up to a teacher and say, you know, I don't think that this is how things are going. I think he deserves an IEP, even though you don't think he does. These are not easy things. You know, we're all human. But yeah, absolutely. We need to empower parents instead of constantly making them feel like they are less than.
Yeah. And then I so agree. I really appreciate those words because I think that it's so true, and it's something that I see every day in practice where we're, as parents, we're apologizing, we're blaming, we're really feeling that guilt, and it's important for us to hear that it's okay. You are doing your best, and you're doing whatever it is that you think is best for your child at this time. Not to say if you have it in your power to continue and to get that diagnosis or to help your child, you shouldn't. Don't sit on your hands. But as parents, we really do want to care for our children, and we do want to get the best, and we're just doing the best that we have at that time. Now, on the reverse end, you mentioned the late diagnosis. So I've spoken to so many individuals that had late diagnoses, and they've told me that it was very comforting to them to hear that they had a diagnosis because they've, went through life thinking like, what's wrong with me? Or what, what did I do different? Or and then when they got that diagnosis, they had a real sense of okay, understanding. What has been your experience with people that were diagnosed a little bit later?
Absolutely. And I've seen this. I see families up to 22, kids up to 22 years. And so I've had a 15, 16-year-old get diagnosed. And I've had experience with diagnosing much older kids, young adults, I should say, with neurodivergence, whether it's ADHD or autism. I just diagnosed a 16-year-old last week with intellectual disability. She's had the, IQ of a sixth grader from the beginning, and she's just fallen through the cracks. And at the age of 16, almost 17, she's finally gotten a diagnosis that fits who she is and can get the supports that she needs. And now we're rushing for guardianship, and now we're rushing for everything. And that school, it doesn't, like I said, the blame game doesn't matter. A late diagnosis is still a diagnosis. It is still a chance to help. And I agree with you. It's the same experience I've had where it's never been an anger, it's been a relief. It's been, I finally know why I am the way I am. One of my best friends, and this isn't in my clinical view, but in my personal life, one of my best friends got diagnosed at 42 with autism because his son, who is now 7, was diagnosed with autism. He was adopted, my friend. And so he had no history of anything. But he saw in his son so many things he used to do as a kid and still does in an adult version. His self-injurious behavior was hitting himself and alcoholism. His social issues and he had masked so hard. And so he went to get diagnosed, and he was diagnosed at 42, and he felt nothing but relief. He saved his marriage, he saved his relationship with his kids, and he is happier now as an autistic adult than he ever was pretending to be a neurotypical adult, masking every day, exhaustion, self-doubt, anxiety, and now he's getting the therapies he needs. Late diagnoses, on one hand, are a shame, but I'm so happy that adult psychologists exist now that specialize in autism diagnosis. That we as developmental pediatricians are seeing up to young adults so that we can try our best to capture mild autism and especially autism in girls, which goes undiagnosed very often
Why do you
until they're
think
much
that
older.
is?
Many, many aspects of it. One is societally, if we have a girl who is unable to keep up socially and goes quiet. And it's a similar thing with ADHD and why the inattentive ADHD girls go undiagnosed is we love a quiet girl. We love a girl who doesn't make a lot of noise. And they mask so much better than boys do at a young age. And so they are much harder to capture because being shy, being quiet is ultimately connected to femininity. And the second men are like that, boys are like that. They're like, whoa, what's going on? He's having issues making friends at the playground. if a girl, oh, she's introverted, she's shy, she's just a little girl, very commonly I will see that, and then it just gets worse, you know. So they mold and mask better because of our expectations of that gender. There's also a large amount of the neurodivergent community that are non-binary, but again, mask themselves into the roles they're supposed to play. And so we are happy to look away as a society, I should say, not as a developmental pediatrician, as that it makes me extremely angry, but and frustrated. But as a society, we're okay with it because they're not, like I said, we're okay with the quiet. And we're happy to look away. So for me, that's my, you know, clinical and observed theories on why girls go longer before getting diagnosed, but also especially non-binary folk who go longer without getting diagnosed because, yeah, it's just, you know, our society's not perfect.
yeah. And you know, people are hesitant to go for the diagnosis. So if it's not like shouting, a lot of times people will just be like, I'd rather not. But then they don't have the tools that they need. Even today in diagnosing, you might know the statistic, but I definitely see a lot more boys than I see girls in my practice.
Historically, the number has been a 4-to-1. But again, I think that's because we capture more boys.
Yeah.
I think that diagnostically speaking, and it goes towards this question of, oh, well, why are there so many more being diagnosed these days? Oh, why are there more diagnoses in New Jersey than other states? You know, it is because of hyper-awareness by physicians and clinicians of all kinds of not missing the mild and moderate versions. We've all been able to always capture the severe, and all of our statistics are based on those. But now that we're capturing more mild cases and we're able to give them the help they need and diagnose them appropriately, then the numbers look like they're going up. But you have to look at sort of the levels of autism in there, and you'll see that, okay, we're capturing a lot more girls these days and a lot more mild forms of it. And that makes sense.
Right. Definitely. Wow. Now, I'm curious to hear, well, maybe if you could tell us, just give us a little background about what's going on in the CDC right now. And then after you explain what's going on, if you could give us a little bit of your insight as far as what your thoughts are on it.
Speaking of an imperfect society.
Exactly. Segueing right in.
Yeah, I think us is, I think everyone's trying the best they can. But I think that information out there is abundant. And that has always been an assumption that that's always a good thing. Because we always assume the information is accurate and is well-meaning and well-published and well-researched. But the truth of the internet has been since, you know, and I'm a millennial, so I'm an elder millennial. And so I've seen this shift, and we were all hopeful. We all wanted the information highway to be just that. But these days, unfortunately, we see the reality of the situation. Now, specifically speaking, you know, nothing about autism should be political. Autism, as well as ADHD, are neurodivergent diagnoses, yes, but they are in a way a normal variant of the human condition. We have neurotypicals, we have neurodivergent, and they think differently, they act differently, doesn't mean they're broken, doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. They have some issues, just like neurotypicals do, and they need the help they need that they get. The causes of autism and ADHD, when specifically autism, because that's what's happening with the CDC these days, is a hot button topic because anytime we don't know something for sure in the clinical community, everybody wants to give an answer and speak louder than other communities. But the facts are the facts. 1998, paper was published in the Lancet that linked MMR to autism, the MMR vaccine. And then 12 years later, I think the Lancet started the investigation in 2004, but about 12 years after the original article was published, they published a retraction. They basically said the published data was flawed. It was biased on many levels, and we can go into the details of that a little bit more. But basically what it said was that he was wrong, that there was no connection with the vaccine, globally speaking. And I think this is a big aspect to remember, is that autism doesn't just exist in the United States. It doesn't just exist in places that have vaccinations. It does not exist where the vaccination schedules are different. But autism shows up around 18 months, 24 months, roughly, across the board. And so if it was related to something, and quote, if it was that simple, we would have made the correlation a long time ago. Just like the Tylenol and autism, you have to understand what correlation means and what cause and effect means. And again, a whole other topic. But in summary of it, in relation with this, is the only voices we have is truth. And the truth is, autism is not caused by the MMR vaccine. It is not caused by Tylenol intake during pregnancy. And that's a much more complicated question there in itself. But the political aspirations of different people, they love grabbing onto these because it is unknown. Because we don't have an answer, just saying that what it is not and not give the answer of what it is what's opening up that opportunity to say, well, aha, you don't have the answer, but I think I do, so I will just speak louder than you do. And that's not how we do things. There's a lot of excellent, promising research happening both on our side and in the European countries like the UK, where they're absolutely looking at some solid theories on what causes autism, because we know some facts. We know that it is a genetic disorder. We know that it is passed on. And we know that most of the time the mutation shows up as a new mutation, and it's not the same mutation. There's been over 20 genes loosely connected, but none that have repeated. Like with Down syndrome, we know there's one that shows up every single time. We know its relationship. We know that other syndromes will show up in Ashkenazi Jews, for example. Like, we know so much information about some of the genetic syndromes, and we put it out there. And one day we'll do the same thing for autism. We'll know exactly the cause, we'll know exactly the mutation, and we will know exactly what is going on. There is a neurological component and theory, especially in the UK and in the central US, some of the big research companies that are being looked at in the US. There's a gut biome theory that is looking at possible gut biome correlations with autism. Again, nothing specific and nothing absolute. So we don't have the answer, but just because we don't have the answer doesn't mean we should listen to the wrong ones. And I think that's what we have to be careful about, is people trying to weaponize our children against us and their diagnoses, and the doctors who are trying their best to get them the help that they need. And that's what we have to be really careful about. And sort of, I try to stay on the positive side. You know, even on our Instagram page, when things were going crazy, I was like, we're not giving them free publicity. We're giving people like Temple Grandin publicity. We're showing the research and the care and the love that is related with autism, and the parents that are persevering through it, the self-advocates that are getting up there and speaking for themselves for the first time in a long time. Let's give them the voice. Let's let them be the loudest voice, and let's not give hate and miscommunication and misinformation a place to live in our society.
Yeah, and just tying back to our previous topic of guilt, like, I've spoken to parents that have brought up the CDC piece, and it definitely makes them feel guilty when they're pointing to factors that might tie to them without sure evidence. So it's good to hear the whole back and forth and understand that back to that. We have enough going on in our lives. We have enough busyness in our lives that this is not something that we should shoulder at this time.
I think you made an excellent point. And as somebody who has a friend who I'm trying to shop for Hanukkah about, and you guys make it really, really difficult, I just want to say, buying one gift is hard enough. But the amount of research that we do, let's say that you have a heart problem. If people go into like the New England Journal of Medicine, they will research up doctors. They will research up their everything. Do the same thing. Do the research you do to buy UGGs for this. Be that critical. And 9 out of 10 times, you'll start to see the truth surface up, because the rest of it just won't hold water. You know, as my cousin Vinny said, it doesn't hold water. And it's just, we have to take it upon ourselves in this information age, and in this age of misinformation being louder, in making sure we vet that information and that we're not harming ourselves. And like you said, guilting ourselves. Oh my God, I gave my kid my vaccination and now I'm the reason. We would all have it. The numbers would be so much higher. Just, it doesn't survive 10 minutes of logic. And so I think that's what we just need to do. We just need to be a little bit more aware of people trying to veer us away from truth.
Yes, yes. And also, like you were just saying, any information that we get, we don't really believe it at face value. Being that this is a vulnerable topic that hits home for a lot of people and makes us feel vulnerable, doesn't mean that we have to give it credit. We have to really think through and do our research before we say, yeah, I believe this. So I'm really happy that you were able to speak about that today a little bit and gives us some clarification. Okay, you also touched on ADHD in your neurodivergent speech over there. Tell us a little bit, and we talk a lot about autism on this podcast. Tell us a little bit about ADHD, why it would be important to get a diagnosis of it. And then I know we have the ADHD, is that how we call it?
Yes.
ADHD. So give us a little bit about that for us to understand.
Absolutely. So sort of what I call more straightforward ADHD are kids who are either hyperactive or inattentive or a little bit of both usually, from a very young age, younger than they would be by school age. You know, on paper, and I should say by DSM-5 criteria, is the age of 12, but really, when developmental pediatricians talk to them, it's been since they could crawl. Their focus attentions, their hyperactive attentions. And I think the most important thing to always remember is that nobody's trying to diagnose a kid who's just neurotypically hyper. Your kid is allowed to be a little Tasmanian devil. Your kid is allowed to be, you know, and I always joke with my families, your kid is totally allowed to be a weird kid. You're allowed to have a weird kid. It's fine. That's not a diagnosis. It's when it goes past a certain point that it is actively harming them, their academic, and their home life, that we need to start looking at how perseverative those symptoms are, for lack of a better word, how persistent they are across all domains. So these have to be present in both domains, in both home and school, or both, you know, grandmother's house and at the, you know, summer camp that they go to. It has to be there everywhere. If it's just there in one place, then that's not ADHD. And getting the diagnosis doesn't always and shouldn't always mean medication. Getting the diagnosis means the same thing it does for autism. It means therapies, appropriate services at school and at home, and the understanding and education of not just the kid, but of the parents, by the kid and by the parents, on what it is, what ADHD is, how it can be helpful in their later life, and why it's a problem now. I always joke with kids, I said, you're going to make an incredible CEO one day. I can't point to a CEO who I don't think has ADHD, a little bit, who is a little neurospicy, as I call them.
I love that.
You got to be, you know, and these kids are so incredible. They don't think outside of the box. There is no box for them. It's a sphere for them, you know. They are incredibly creative and energetic, and sure, it's to a point where it's hurting them now, but why don't we teach them the coping skills that need to organize their life, to have better executive function skills, and to moderate their behaviors and put their energies towards the correct thing. Go join a soccer team. And if and when it is needed, do medications. But there's a time and place for that. After you've put in all the therapeutic supports and behavioral supports, if we need a little bit of medication for a little while to help the kid get to where they need to get to faster, I think that's wonderful. It needs to be systematic. It needs to be low dose. It needs to be educated and counseled to death in detail. And then there's always got to be a plan of when do we get him off the meds.
And I love that you're saying that, because being in the education field, working very closely with educators, you know, as an occupational therapist, in the ABA field as well, I feel like a lot of times teachers are exasperated and they love those pills and they just want to say pills. And when parents come to me and they're like, I think he has ADHD. The doctor says if I want pills, I could get pills. And I always say, like, so what'd you do prior to the pills? Like, did you attempt anything? Did you give him sensory regulation for a couple months first? Did you check out if he's missing certain skill sets and that's why he's being difficult in class? Like, what'd you do before you're slapping this pill on a child? Not to say that sometimes children don't need those pills. They do need the pills, the ones that need them. But we have to just be open-minded and do our research and make sure that our child got everything and that we gave them the skills to get there. And then maybe we need a little help with medication to get us to our goal. But then we have, once on the medication, then we have to be working towards that goal to get the child off the medication. Because, you know, if you speak to, you know, certain adults, they feel like it changed their lives and it's the best thing for them and they need to be there. But other ones you speak to will talk about how it, what side effects the medication had for them and how they had to almost, you know, be like a drug addict to wean themselves off of it. And again, I think the big piece here is going on to it with the knowledge that I have a goal here, that I need to plug up those skills. I need to learn to self-regulate. I need to be by a psychologist and work through those skills to gain them. I need to be by a therapist to gain those skills so that eventually we can come off of it. Again, there is a place in this world for medication. I'm not saying that there's not. And in certain instances, we can come off the medication, and that's the only way that we'll be able to manage our symptoms. And that's okay too. But I feel like as a caregiver, as a parent, it's really important to make that choice smartly, educated, and like you said, with a lot of counseling and a lot of speaking to our practitioner and telling them the symptoms and telling them what we're doing in order to get to a better place with our children.
Absolutely. It should be part of the conversation, not the conversation. And there's cognitive behavioral therapy. There is honestly some instances where if the kid is young enough, there's an aspect of ABA therapy that's needed for this ADHD kid. And you touched on the diagnosis a little bit before, is our autistic kids who also have ADHD, and a developmental pediatrician or someone who's very, very similarly trained needs to separate those two out and make sure that we're not confusing one for the other and has those diagnoses. But those kids are an especially special population, both mentally speaking and physically speaking. And just to give you a little snippet of it, physically speaking, they react to the same medications differently than a kid who just has ADHD. Simply put, their physiology is different. So we need to be careful when we medicate our ADHD kids, which is AUDHD, which is just a combination of autism and ADHD for anybody who's confused. The individuals are really, really fascinating, behaviorally speaking, because there are some aspects of ADHD that is in direct opposition of what autistic individuals feel. And it's a fight inside. You know, oh, I like chaos. My ADHD side likes chaos, but my autistic side does not like change in routine and chaos and likes, you know, the sameness. And wait, how is this in the same person? They need, you know, the therapies are different for them. but their physiological neurotransmitter level, on a neurotransmitter level, they're different too. So we have to be careful in giving them the same medications because they will react very differently than if I gave the same exact medication to a twin that just had ADHD. So we have to be, you know, we have to be very aware of who we're managing and how we're managing them. But yeah, there's creative ways of therapies too. Cognitive behavioral therapy only starts at the age of 7. So what if you have a 4-year-old who you just diagnosed? There, you have to get creative on how to get these executive function skill teaching and training and therapies going in younger kids as well. So just, it's a little bit more work.
Yeah, it's a little more work and figuring out the right recipe because there's no one recipe that works for everyone. And on the medication, and the same, if that's the route that you must go, I've seen clients that have had to try multiple medications to get to the right point, to find the right place, and speaking to your practitioner and figuring it out as a team is so important. Back to, there's not one right recipe.
Absolutely. And the correct practitioner is so important. Somebody who has the time to really spend with you, not somebody who sees you for 5 minutes and, you know, they've got 30 other patients on the docket, right? You, like I said, we're all fallible. So you have to be nitpicky about the doctor that you end up with because, you know, my follow-ups, for example, are 30 minutes long. Right. And I find most of the time that's not enough time because I'm not done counseling. I'm not done talking to them about the side effects. I'm not done talking to them about how now we need to choose about a kid who's on meds, doing well, finally passing his grades and finally has stopped hitting other kids. But at the same time, feels like he's not as creative anymore. That's a complicated discussion we need to talk about. So you have to be ready to work with a doctor or a clinician who has a very systematic approach, and that's the most important thing. There's about 30 to 40 medications that are ADHD, but every doctor that you work with needs to have that systematic approach of how we go about trying different things and how we rule out which meds work and which don't. Because if you're just sort of randomly throwing meds at this kid, you know, you're doing them a disservice and you're turning them against possible help through medication forever. You know, and for their kids, it affects like entire generations. I've had dads who are like, nope, I was on Adderall when I was a kid and I hated it. My kid is never going to be on ADHD meds. And I was like, oh, good. Now I'm trying to fix a doctor's mistake from 40 years ago. Great. You know, so yeah, we have to be careful. On the parent side, I would just suggest that they do their research. And if they are not happy with the path that they're medication person is taking, because that could be a psychiatrist, that could be a developmental pediatrician, it could be a general pediatrician. If they're not, then go get a second opinion. Go talk to someone else. Talk to a third person. Doesn't matter. It's your kid and it's his body, their body. So take your time.
Amazing. Wow. Okay. You have shared with us so much today. I think all this information was so valuable and so encouraging and really shed light on challenges that parents go through every single day. So I definitely think you've touched some of us. If you had to end off with one message to give to parents or caregivers of children that are neurodiverse, what would that message be?
It's hard to shorten it because I don't like random quotes, but I will say, speak up and speak up often. For your own rights, for your child's rights, for your child's health, for your own health, for your own voice. And it is a marathon. So that's why I speak up and speak up often and never stop fighting. Because you or your child have every right to be yourself and get the help that you need than anybody else. And don't give up. Never, ever give up.
I love that. I love the inspiration. Thank you so much for coming on and joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been amazing. Thank you so much.